Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Political memoirs seemed like required reading this year. Dreams from My Father, Faith of My Fathers, and a lot more. But life and books are more than politics, even in an election year. New York Times correspondent Dexter Filkin sent frontline dispatchers on the Forever War. A deaf mute named Edgar Sawtelle got the critics and Oprah singing praises. Jhumpa Lahiri was back. Toni Morrison found mercy. This hour On Point, the best reads of 2008. You can join the conversation. What book kept you reading late into the night this year? What got the rave reviews in your book club? Which books are you wrapping up as holiday presents? Three great readers with us today. From New York is Liesl Schillinger, a regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review and columnist for the Times Style section. Liesl, welcome back. Wonderful to have you.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. From St. Louis, Missouri, Chris Kleindienst, co-owner of Left Bank Books, independent bookstore, fixture in St. Louis since 1969. The enterprise is expanding. Second location opens tomorrow. Chris, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. You're welcome, Tom.
It's great to have you. And from Santa Monica, California, we're joined by Mark Sarvis. He hosts the popular literary weblog, The Elegant Variation. His own debut novel, Harry Revised, is in the mix this year. Mark Sarvis, welcome.
Thank you, Tom.
And I should say right off the top, listeners, we've got a full list of all of our guests' top picks at our website, onpointradio.org. Liesl, what kind of year was this for books? Can you characterize it? A lot of competition from all the political narrative out there.
Well, you know, I have a book club, and we read all the books we're excited about, month in, month out. Yeah. And usually there's a lot of new fiction, and there was this year. We read Lush Life by Richard Price. And we are also reading political books this year, though. People kept on getting so distracted by the election that they wanted to read the political books that were out there.
I'm looking just at the top of your lists. Mark, you've got Netherland by Joseph O'Neill, Nobility of Spirit, A Forgotten Ideal by Rob Riemann, Reappraisals by Tony Jutt. You've got a sort of a philosophical, political tint there, but then in Netherland, Something About New York we'll talk about. Chris, you've got American Wife, a little politics from a different angle, an imagined story of a first lady closely inspired by Laura Bush. And then you and Oprah both have the story of Edgar Sawtelle from David Rubluski. And American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House, John Meacham. We spoke with him not long ago. How do you decide what goes at the top of your list, Chris? Is it what people are buying in the bookstore or what you think they ought to buy?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. It's what people are buying, and it's also what me and my fellow booksellers are reading and excited about.
And Mark, how about you? Netherland, right at the top of your list. Tell us about it.
Well, Netherland is one of those books. It seems to have elicited near universal praise. There have been a few dissenters, I think Zadie Smith most notably in the New York Review of Books. Mm. But it's that rare book that seems to have brought on critics all across the board, from Dwight Garner to Michiko Kakutani to James Wood. And it really was a novel, you know, readers, some of us use the expression, took my head off. And of all the novels I read this year, it's the one that really took my head off. And I felt is as good a novel as I have read, not just this year, but in the last few years.
You call it a Gatsby-like meditation on exclusion and otherness, an unforgettable New York story. What's the story at the heart of Netherland, Mark?
Well, the heart of the story is an unlikely friendship between a Dutch-born British expatriate who is a banker and living in New York and sort of during and immediately after 9/11, estranged from his wife, who goes back to the UK in the wake of the attack, sort of shaken up by it, nominally shaken up by it. In truth, there's trouble in their marriage. And he befriends a Trinidadian immigrant named Chick Ramkissoon, I'm never sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, who brings him into this wonderful, weird underworld of cricket in New York, which at that point, you know, is largely populated by Jamaican immigrants, Caribbean immigrants, and it's a friendship that is not unlike the friendship between Jay Gatsby and Nick Carraway and The Great Gatsby. And there's something a little bit shady and a little bit attractive about Chick. And during their time together. Hans, the narrator, is trying to come to terms with what is going on with his marriage, what is going on with his life in New York, and it's exquisitely written. It's one of those books where I simultaneously was hurrying back to it, but only wanted to take it a few pages at
a
time.
Right, so you don't get through it too quickly. The New York City of the immigrant margins is unforgettably invoked here, you wrote. Could you read a little bit from Netherland for us, Mark?
Sure. I've selected just a short bit right from the opening that actually describes the first time that Chuck and Hans meet. And they are out at a cricket field in New York in Staten Island.
The Dutch banker estranged from an English wife in New York and the mysterious cricket entrepreneur Chuck Ramkissoon.
That's right. You've got it just right. Mm. Chuck and I met for the first time in August 2002. I was playing cricket at Randolph Walker Park in Staten Island, and Chuck was present as one of the two independent umpires who gave their services in return for a $50 honorarium. The day was thick as a jelly, with a hot, glassy atmosphere and no wind, not even a breeze from the Kill of Cull, which flows less than 200 yards from Walker Park and separates Staten Island from New Jersey. Far away in the south was the mumbling of thunder. It was that kind of barbarously sticky American afternoon that made me yearn for the shadows cast by scooting summer clouds in northern Europe, yearn even for those days when you play cricket wearing two sweaters under a cold sky, patched here and there by a blue tatter, enough to make a sailor's pants, as my mother used to say. Mm-hmm. And I love that mumbling of thunder. I think that's just wonderful.
Mark Sarvis reading there from Netherland by Joseph O'Neill. Liesl Schillinger, you've got a very New York story at the top of your list, Black Flies by Shannon Burke. Maybe a different side of town, but not so different. Tell us the story of Black Flies.
First, if I could say, I also underlined that passage Mark read from Netherland. And the way Joseph O'Neill described New York was so almost wolfy, and I thought there's such an Edwardian tone to that novel, even though it was set in during 9/11 and around it. But Back to Black Flies, this book took my breath away. I was shocked by it, and it's understated, and its power, it's very masculine. It's a man who's conflicted about who he is, who didn't get into med school the first time round, who signs up to be an EMT, a medic in Harlem. And he's with a kind of Serpico-like, kind of corrupt crew of people who are pretty cynical about the lives they are saving or not saving. And the visual pictures of the kind of carnage that a medic sees are so beautifully done by Shannon Burke. I remember there is one of he goes to the site of an elevator crash, and the description of what's inside that elevator made me think of that old painting, The Raft of the Medusa.
Oh my God!
He's just so visual, but it's really understated emotion.
You've got a small reading from that you might share with us. The protagonist, Ollie Cross, part of a cynical crew of EMT paramedics in Harlem, finds a 12-year-old girl here lying in a pool of water in a dark basement laundry room. He writes, I was pretty sure she'd been electrocuted. If I touched her, I could be electrocuted too. Read some from there.
Sure. So this is Ollie has slowly become less cynical, and he's starting to respect life. So anyway, he takes the risk, and he puts the shock paddles on her chest. And he writes, I felt for a pulse with one hand, and with the other raised the flashlight and shone it in her face, and saw something unbelievable, something I'd never seen before. With my one hand, I felt a pulse in her neck, a pulse that quickened rapidly and grew stronger, and with the light on her, I watched as her dead gray face flushed over with life. There was a sudden heaving in her chest and a rattling sound in her throat. It was the most eerie, unnatural thing I'd ever witnessed. I watched death recede from her.
There, from Shannon Burke's Black Flies, a novel. Liesl, I mean, here's a second New York book, and it's taking your breath away, even though you know New York very well. I mean, what gets shown here that you didn't know already or shown in a new way?
Well, for me, I actually would meld it with O'Neill and with Shannon Burke. This is a city I've lived in for 20 years and know intimately. I know the man who dances with a tango puppet in the Times Square subway. Mm-hmm. I know that part of Harlem. I've got friends who went to med school up there. But I guess I was too busy living in this environment to pay heed to the story that's unfolding around us. And these two men made me stop and take note. Also, they are putting emotions in the minds of reticent men whose thoughts are interesting to me and a puzzle to me. So
you also, on your list, you've got Black Flies at the top, The Sacred Book of the Werewolf by Victoria Pelevin there, Family Planning by Karan Mahjan, and Beautiful Children by Charles Bach. This one, set in a very different city, Las Vegas. What brought Beautiful Children onto your list, Liesl?
Well, you know, one thing that's interested me lately in moods in fiction is how many stories are focused in on one person and his own little drama. Mm-hmm. And there was a more 19th century sprawl to the ambition of Charles Bach's story. I mean, he was enfolding six or seven or eight different social worlds, families, kids, strippers. There's the issue of missing children. There were pawnbrokers. I mean, that's a profession I really haven't seen much of outside of Dostoevsky.
Yeah.
And so he was just filling in the American West and Southwest with an amount of texture I haven't seen that many, and a scope that I haven't seen all that many people attempt. It was a big screen he was filling.
We've got a lot more books to look at here. Looking on down Chris Kleindienst's list, from St. Louis, The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family by Annette Gordon Reed, The Wordy Shipmates by Sarah Vowell, public radio listeners know her well, The Art of Racing in the Rain by Garth Stein. When we come back, we're going to talk about those, hear some more readings, and hear from you, dear listeners, on what books caught your attention this year most rewardingly. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking about great books of 2008 with some pretty great readers, you included this hour. Mark Sarvis joins us from Santa Monica, California. He's host of the literary web blog The Elegant Variation. Chris Kleindienst is here. She's co-owner of Left Bank Books, independent bookstore in St. Louis, opening a new location tomorrow at 321 North 10th Street in downtown St. Louis. And Liesl Schillinger is with us, regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review and columnist for the Style section there. You can see all of the recommendations from my guest today at our website, onpointradio.org. Liesl Schillinger mentioned Charles Bach and Beautiful Children. Charles Bach was with us on February 1st. This is a book that really catches the dark side of Las Vegas. Here's a little reading. Charles Bach, the author himself reading, where a teenage girl he calls the girl with the shaved head sets the stage for why she will run away from home. Let's listen back to the author of Beautiful Children, Charles Bach.
The girl would wake to a crush of hot breath and whiskey and perfume, and she would hear her mother weeping. She would hear how much her mother hated men, how much her mother hated her own life. The girl would lie there feeling helpless and trapped, and also that her mother was kind of pathetic. And although the girl had a tender and unspeakable love for her mother, she felt distant from her mother too. The girl was strong. She was smart. She was never going to end up like her mother. No freaking way.
No freaking way, says Charles Bach, reading there from his Beautiful Children on Liesl Schillinger's Top 10 for 08 list. The Washington Post and everybody else have their lists out right now. One of the Post top 10 best picks is the novel Cost by Roxana Robinson. Gripping story of family trauma and a summer in Maine. Roxana Robinson was with us on June 25th. A different feeling right here. Let's listen back.
What she felt when her parents were here was something large and unsayable, confusing, nearly unbearable. Affection, anxiety, resentment, although she was an adult with her own children, nearly grown, and she should long ago have moved beyond this confusion. But her parents' presence still unsettled her. When they were here, the house seemed small and ill-equipped, the doors put on backward, the light switches unconnected, a troubling dreamscape where nothing was right.
And there we have Roxana Robinson reading from Cost, Washington Post top pick. Let's go to Kate in Norwich, Connecticut, and see what we've got here. Kate, what did you love?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for allowing me to put my opinion in here. It's
sure.
Really great to be able to participate.
Wonderful.
You know, two of the books you've mentioned, The Art of Racing in the Rain, or one of them anyway, I read and was fascinated by. It was really a terrific story. And I just finished Wally Lamb's newest book, The Hour I First Believed.
Mm-hmm.
which was brilliant as always.
Wally Lamb, who wrote She's Come Undone and I Know This Much Is True.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he's just published his newest book, The Hour I First Believed. And because he's a local author and taught here in Norwich for years and years, you know, obviously a great number of the pieces and passages in the book resonate with me because I know the places he's referring to, but he has an ability to speak from the female perspective in each of his books, and again in this one, that's really a remarkable book. It's a big book, it's a long read, but it was just exceptional.
And The Art of Racing in the Rain, Garth Stein, that was on is on Chris Kleindienst's list of favorites. What captured you about it, Kate?
I found Denny to be the most sympathetic character.
What's the story? Tell us the story.
Well, Denny is a auto mechanic who is in love with racing and is actually quite good at it. And I think the best part of the story is his dog, who becomes the central figure in his life while he gets married and has a child and his wife becomes ill and succumbs to cancer and his in-laws try to take this child from him. His dog is his steady friend, and the story is told from the dog's perspective. The dog being someone or something that is a step away from, in his next life, becoming human, which was a really curious way to tell the story. But he did it so artfully, it had me looking at my dogs and wondering just exactly what was going through their head.
What's on their mind? What are they? Will they be the next great auto racer 50 years from now? Enzo the dog. Kate, thanks very much for that. Chris, I know you've got a little reading from The Art of Racing in the Rain by Garth Stein. Give us your sense of this book and give us a little read, Chris.
Sure. I'd like to read a couple sentences right from the beginning and then a tiny passage farther in that gives you a sense of why telling this story from the dog's perspective is so wonderful, because he's a bit of a philosopher. It okay. starts, "Gestures are all that I have. Sometimes they must be grand in nature. And while I occasionally step over the line and into the world of the melodramatic, it is what I must do in order to communicate clearly and effectively." And later in the book, when his human companion, Denny, has been picked up by the police in the course of this story where they're trying to take his child away from him, and he's sitting in an interrogation room for hours and being denied everything. They're not talking to him. They're not even bringing him coffee. Mm. The dog, Enzo, is wondering what that was like for him, and he says, "Did he despair? Did he silently berate himself for allowing himself to be in that situation? Or did he finally realize what it is like to be me, to be a dog? Did he understand, as those interminable minutes ticked by, that being alone is not the same as being lonely, that being alone is a neutral state? It is like a blind fish at the bottom of the ocean, without eyes and therefore without judgment."
We walk a mile in the collar of Enzo the dog in The Art of Racing in the Rain. Kate, thanks for calling. And Chris, thanks very much for that reading. Let's get a call from San Francisco and David. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hey, I wanted to speak of the emergence with the big book just coming with that great, amazing front-page rule. Front page review in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. I'm talking about Roberto Bolaño and his new book, 2666, but his other books that have come out very recently, all have come out and translated since he died, like Nazi Writers in the Americas and Savage Detectives. He seems to bring together, Borges? He seems to bring together Borges, kind of Celine, his intellectual inquiries, historical inquiries, and two, the low life, the Lupin literary life in Mexico City, the Chilean writer, Bolaño. Talk a bit about him.
Wonderful. David, thanks very much. Roberto Bolaño of Chile. I don't know, Liesl, Chris, Mark, I haven't read this one yet. 2666, it's got some big play. Liesl, what do you know?
Well, I absolutely loved The Savage Detectives, which is which came out, I think, last year. I don't remember who did it. Maybe it was FSG. Loved it. And I love the caller mentions Celine and Borges, and also makes me think of Rob Grier's Structuralist. I mean, he really plays with form. It's delicious. Now, I don't know if that book itself must have been 700-800 pages long. I'm going to read another Bolaño. I will read 2666, but I need a little break. But I'm looking forward to it.
Mark, what are you hearing?
Well, I'm in the same almost identical boat as Liesl in that I loved the Savage Detectives. A few years ago, I participated in a an online book contest called The Rooster and was really hard advocating for Savage Detectives and was heartbroken when it was eliminated. And 2666 is sitting threateningly on my desk, awaiting my attention.
Okay.
But I've had a few assignments. But, you know, you asked earlier about trends, and I'm generally suspicious of trends. They feel a little bit like marketing conceits, but it does seem like every few years publishing finds a great deceased author and begins churning out their back titles to an appreciative public. I'm thinking of, you know, Irene Nemirovsky recently, and now we have Roberto Bolaño, and maybe dead authors are easier to deal with than living ones. I don't know.
Roberto Bolaño in 2666. Mark, you've got some serious reads on this book, Nobility of Spirit. Not to mention Tony Judd and Reappraisals, his collection of essays there, but Nobility of Spirit sets out with an unusual mission these days. This is not a novel, but rather kind of a very long essay. How would you describe it? Tell us about it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's one of those happy accidents for me because unlike, you know, a true working critic like Liesl, I think my taste and attention sometimes is a little bit blinkered because I self-select things that I'm interested in. So when something hits my radar that's off the beaten track a little bit, it's great. And with Nobility of Spirit came to me from the Yale University Press, and its author, Rob Riemann, is the founder and CEO of this European secular think tank called the Nexus Institute. And he has sort of taken the lives of some of his intellectual heroes, Thomas Mann most notably among them, and written this, basically three joined essays that all deal with these questions of high art, high ideals. He's, you know, it's in some ways it's an unfashionable argument these days, but
the whole concept of nobility of spirit,
exactly, and high art and art for its own sake. But what I took away from the book and what really moved me is this notion of, you know, what we lose when we become a culture that is consumed with, you know, pursuit of material gain. I think what we're seeing with the meltdown of, you know, our economic meltdown right now speaks to some of those dangers. And this book hit my radar, you know, about the same time as the last year's campaign was unfolding. And there was an ugly sort of anti-intellectual streak in the campaign, and it's something that you see in American life a little bit too often. And I think his book is a persuasive argument for why spending some time in the company of these great thinkers is valuable.
And you've got a lot on your list. You go to Daniel Mendelsohn and How Beautiful It Is and How Easily It Can Be Broken, The Journal of Jules Renard, Paris Review Interviews, the third volume out now there, and Immovable Feast, A Paris Christmas, and then Stray Dog Winter. What's this? Something by David Francis out of Cold War Moscow, Mark?
That's right. Stray Dog Winter is the second novel by David Francis, who's an Australian novelist. His first book was released in this country under the title The Great Inland Sea from McAdam Cage. And he's followed it up with something very different. And again, it was interesting to include it on my list because it's got real thriller dimensions, but in the style of Graham Greene. I mean, it is a literate, thoughtful thriller. And it's a story about an Australian who visits his half-sister in Moscow at the height of the Cold War and misbehaves, does some things that are ill-advised, were ill-advised to be doing in Moscow at that time, and gets drawn into this pretty high-level assassination plot as he's trying to extricate himself and get himself safely back to Australia. And I was actually fortunate enough to read this book in its manuscript, so I've watched its evolution, and it's beautifully written. It mixes those best qualities of being beautifully written, but also there's a real compelling narrative. There's a reason to keep turning the pages to find out what happens next.
A thriller set in Cold War Moscow, Stray Dog Winter by David Francis. Let's take a call from Mandy in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Mandy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just have a second here, and you do too, to tell you that my favorite book of the year was by a new author called Nina de Grammont. And she wrote a book called Gossip of the Starlings. And for me, language is what counts. If I don't care what the story's about if it's not well written. And she writes absolutely beautifully, stunningly. And it's about three teenage girls who are friends, who, you know, they're innocent and they're reckless. And I found that it's a better book for teenagers, really, then, and all the risks inherent in there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I'm walking very fast, if you can tell.
Oh, boy. These are, and the author's name is Nina. Give us her name again. Nina DeGarmond?
DeGarmond. I haven't heard of her before.
All right.
She has such command of language, and she's writing about these alpha girls and what happens with friendship. They're naive, they're innocent, and it's a very dangerous time, and adults can't always see it. But this is fascinating, and it's I would recommend it.
We'll put it right on our list here, Mandy. Gossip of the Starlings. Mandy's calling in from Rhode Island. Liesl, you've got Jhumpa Lahiri on your list. Again, this year, Unaccustomed Earth is her book. She spent time, of course, in Delhi and all over, and Rhode Island at what point. What is Unaccustomed Earth? What's the focus? What is it, Liesl?
It's a collection of her stories about the Bengali diaspora, basically mostly in America, but also in England, but almost entirely in America. But this is really stories of the second generation of Bengali Americans and how they interact with their parents, who are first generation, and then the ties that go back a little deeper. But it's just, I guess it's just showing the evolution of our own human landscape, I guess, in this country, and deepening this color of international origin. I don't know how to explain it, except that each of the stories is so resonant, and to me it transcends nationality or race. These are just human experiences accented by the origins she gives them.
Unaccustomed Earth by Jhumpa Lahiri. Liesl, you've also got a Russia-based story, Stalin's Children by Owen Matthews. Tell us about that.
Well, I think Mark was mentioning Stray Dog Winter, which was a Cold War novel with drama set in Moscow. This is a nonfiction story. This is a memoir by Owen Matthews, who is bureau chief for Newsweek, I think, in Moscow. But his grandfather, Boris Bibikov, was killed during Stalin's purges. His mother, Ludmila Bibikova, Matthews, was raised an orphan as an enemy of the people's daughter, and met his father, who was a sort of stubborn grad student in Moscow in the 60s. So the book has three parts. It's the purges and his grandfather. It's the Cold War and his father's terribly annoying fight to get the British authorities and Soviet authorities to let his mother come marry him and move to England, and then his own story in wild hedonistic post-communist Moscow. And I lived in Moscow for a while in the 90s too, and my parents are Russian professors. So for me to see this beautiful teller, that's Owen Matthews, put together this history, which comes from his own family background, was so intoxicating.
Terrific reviews for that book, and what a fascinating story. Chris, what do you find your bookstore patrons looking for? Is to talk about trends. Is there a trend in appetites this year with the economy and politics and everything else? Do people want escape? Do they want insight? What?
Well, that's interesting that you asked that question, because I think what I've noticed, particularly as we've moved into the fall, there has been a very increased appetite for books on American history, especially presidential kinds of biographies, and just a curiosity about our country again that I haven't seen for a while.
Maybe to help people make sense of what's going on out there in this great big country. A couple more on your list, the Oxford Project. Annie Leibovitz at work. Of course, she's out with a new collection of her photographs and how she got them. Chris Kleindienst, Liesl Schillinger, Mark Sarvis, please stand by. We're talking about great books of 2008. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about great books of the year 2008, the year coming soon to a close right now. Liesl Schillinger is with us, contributor to the New York Times Book Review. Mark Sarvis is here from Santa Monica. He's the host of the literary weblog, The Elegant Variation. Chris Kleindienst is with us from St. Louis, co-owner of Left Bank Books in St. Louis. Liesl, do you want to read just a little bit from that Jhumpa Lahiri, Unaccustomed earth that you mentioned there?
Absolutely. And makes me think a little bit of the reader who called in about Nina de Grammont in the book, The Gossip of the Starlings, because this is about a young woman who didn't understand her mother's feelings, but now as an older woman, she's discovering the pain her mother endured during a secret, unrequited affair when her mother was in love with a man named Pranab, whom the little girl knew as Uncle Pranab, Pranab Kaku.
Hmm.
So she writes, this is her story about how her mother reacted to news of Pranab's marriage. A few weeks after Pranab Kaku's wedding, while I was at a Girl Scout meeting and my father was at work, she'd gone through the house gathering up all the safety pins that lurked in drawers and tins. When she'd found enough, she pinned them to her sari one by one, attaching the front piece to the layer of material underneath so that no one would be able to pull the garment off her body. Then she took a can of lighter fluid and a box of kitchen matches and stepped outside into our chilly backyard. Now, the mother didn't light that match, and she didn't tell anybody how she suffered until many years later when she told this daughter. And the daughter writes, "It was to me that she confessed after my own heart was broken by a man I'd hoped to marry." And so we see that in two generations, love and pain and disappointment continue and change, and survival of love continues, even though the girl is so much more Americanized than her mother.
Mm. There, Lisa Schillinger reading from Jhumpa Lahiri's Unaccustomed Earth. And, of course, that phrase coming from Nathaniel Hawthorne, who, in the Custom House, he wrote, "The human fortunes may be improved if men and women, quote, strike their roots into unaccustomed earth." And, of course, many generations have done exactly that in the United States. And, you know, Mark, I wanted to hear a little bit. You've got a reading from Stray Dog Winter, which you began to describe, the post-Cold War thriller in Moscow. I'd love just to get a sense of that. Could you read us just a bit from David Francis' book?
Sure. And actually, this is the very opening of the book. And one of the things I love about the book is how beautifully he captures the freezing, you know, desolate winters. And in this first scene, the photograph that he takes is what gets him into subsequent trouble. So this is right at the very beginning, first paragraph of Stray Dog Winter. "He arrived in winter on a sleeper from Prague, and the sound of the train went, 'Boogity boogity, what do you want, Darcy Bright? Darcy Bright, what do you want?' He pressed his open hand against the shivering window, and the edges of the sky seemed unnaturally close. A figure trudging along in a snow-beaded field with a scythe. A scarved woman behind a wooden fence shaded her face as if there were sunlight. A row of sheets hung flat behind her, mute as teeth, and a pair of what looked like silver foxes capered in the snow. Darcy pulled up his Pentax and snapped a quick shot, feeling foreign, unaccountable. 'I could paint that,' he thought. Then he noticed the food seller watching him from the dark and noisy space between compartments. Darcy lowered the camera, smiled. 'The meaningless incidents present the most danger,' that's what Dostoevsky said. Photos Moscow and Leningrad just said, 'Don't take pictures of anything strategic.'"
Mark Sarvis reading there from David Francis' Stray Dog Winter. And there, between Jhumpa Lahiri and David Francis, we get that wonderful sort of right around the world effect that books can give us just by opening the covers. We had Dexter Filkins with us. Let's make one more jump while our minds are traveling here. New York Times correspondent wrote The Forever War, made the Times Best 10 list for the year. Chilling on-the-ground account of wars in wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Here's Dexter Filkins reading a passage about the start of the 2004 battle for Fallujah from The Forever War. Let's listen back.
"It was 2 a.m. The minarets were flashing by the light of airstrikes, and rockets were sailing on trails of sparks. First came the voices from the mosques, rising above the thundery guns. 'The Americans are here,' howled a voice from a loudspeaker in a minaret. 'The holy war, the holy war. Get up and fight for the city of mosques.' Bullets poured without direction and without end. No one lifted his head. 'This is crazy,' one of the Marines yelled to his buddy over the noise. 'Yeah,' the buddy yelled back, 'and we've only taken one house.'"
Unaccustomed Earth, Stray Dog Winter, and there Dexter Filkins reading from The Forever War. And right around the world we go. Let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Andrew. You're on the air, Andrew. Hi, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The best book that I, well, one of my favorite books this year is a novel by David Lodge called Death Sentence. And
Deaf as in D-E-A-F.
Mm-hmm. He's playing with the pun there. It deals with a linguistics professor, retired linguistics professor in his mid-60s, who has been losing his hearing, and it examines the implications of this disability in relation to his spouse, his professional life, his aging father. It's a very rich, dimensional book that touches on serious considerations of mortality, beautifully written and trenchant observations.
Death Sentence by David Lodge, a linguist losing his hearing. Does he come to terms, or is it more complicated than that, Andrew, with his with that particular loss?
I don't know how to answer that question. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Well, it must be a rich book then. That's good. That's good in a way.
14th novel, and I've never read anything by Lodge, but I will certainly be looking for more.
Wonderful. Thanks for the recommendation. Let's go to Connie in Rye, New Hampshire. Connie, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is a wonderful show. My favorite book of this year is a book called The Great Man, by a young novelist called Kate Christensen. And the main characters in the book are all elderly women, and they are related in some way to the great man who is dead, and he was a famous artist. His sister, who is 84, is also a well-known abstract artist.
What's the setting, Connie? What part of the country or the world?
New York City.
Mm-hmm.
It all takes place in New York City.
Contemporary or historical? Or
contemporary. Mm-hmm. In fact, it is framed by a supposed New York Times obituary of the great man, who, of course, is not all that brave.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beginning, and the end is a review of two biographies of the great man. And the novel is framed around these two biographers interacting with the women in his life.
So does The Great Man end up a kind of a story about the great women? Is that the...
Exactly. And the reason they're great and the reason I loved this book is because their average age is something like 78. And none of them is the wise old auntie or grandmother that you see so often in novels, nor is any of them the miserable burden on her family that you see so often in novels. These are great ladies. They are alive. They're planning for their future. They're interested in establishing relationships with other men or women, as one of them is a lesbian. Just a terrific read on so many levels.
All
this
right.
Book, my book club did this book at my recommendation, and everybody loved it, highly unusual. And the discussion really was no discussion at all. It was just, oh, this was my favorite thing. That was my favorite thing.
We want to live that. Sounds like high spirits of some great women in The Great Man by Kate Christensen. Thanks very much for that, Connie. Let me get one more right here from Buffalo, New York. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I would like to commend the Journal of Helene Baer to your listeners. It's published by Weinstein Books, a translation of a journal of a young woman who had just graduated from the Sorbonne in Paris during World War II. And this is her, she's Jewish, and this is her journal.
And this is Helene, like H-E-L-E-N-E-B-E-R-R?
H-E-L-E-N-E. Baer, B-E-R-R.
Is it an Anne Frank kind of journal, or more out in the streets, in the life, in the world, as it sort of fell apart there?
It is very, very much like the Anne Frank story, but this woman lived her life in public, and we for some reason don't associate a city like Paris with being involved in some of that horror. And to read it in the first hand is very, very moving. Although it's a sad story, it's a necessary reminder for all of us of how how bad things really can be.
Mm. Kevin, thank you very much for the suggestion, The Journal of Hélène Bear. Chris, you've got the Hemingses of Monticello on your list. Of course, going back to Sally Hemings, Annette Gordon Reed's book. It's got such rave reviews. I haven't had a chance to get to it. I had thought that we'd sort of read everything there was to be read about Sally Hemings, but it makes your list, and high praise for many others as well. What puts it there for you?
Well, I think there actually was more to say, because Sally Hemings was in a context of an entire multi-generational family that intertwined between the Hemings and the Jeffersons. And apparently there was quite a bit of original source material that hasn't been mined very much in previous books. And what Annette Gordon Reed did was really take some time and delve quite deeply into that material and reconstruct the lives of several generations here very vividly. It definitely is serious piece of history written, you know, from a historian's perspective. Yet the narrative quality in it is very strong, and you get quite involved in the lives of these people in an emotional way as well. And I think it paints a much richer portrait of what was really happening there at that time.
A rich time for us right now, maybe, with Barack Obama headed into the White House to consider that.
Exactly. I think it's resonant on a number of levels.
From Annette Gordon Reed. Mark, you've got a reading from, we're coming up on holidays here, you've got Immovable Feast, A Paris Christmas. Now, this is the story of what an Australian expat who has the challenge of cooking dinner for his French in-laws at the holidays time, by John Baxter. That sounds like a pretty daunting thing for anyone to face. Could you tell us a bit about it and read a bit from it, Mark?
Sure. I'm happy to. Before I do, very briefly, I want to second your caller's recommendation of the great man Kate Christensen's novel. It's a wonderful piece of work, and sort of captures that New York art world. And I think painting is one of those things, like music, that is very difficult to write convincingly about in fiction. And she does that beautifully. So that's a great choice. You know, I'm a great Francophile, not terribly original, but there it is. And anyone who spent any time over there has, you know, at some point or another come in contact with the forbidding French. And what John Baxter did was he went the extra mile, and he actually married a woman who he met in France. And so he was really an outsider coming into this family. And the French all have these very mystifying rules of comportment and rituals. And he finally knew he had achieved acceptance with his family when he was tasked to prepare their Christmas feast, which is, an 18-people meal in their ancestral country home. And he's very witty. He was a film critic in Los Angeles, and he writes wonderfully about the culture clashes between, you know, the French and Americans. And since we have a literary bent here, I thought I'd read a little portion where he's talking about the importance of cheese to the French.
Okay.
And he says, cheese to the French is an absolute, an axiom of cuisine. Correctly experiencing its pleasures requires education, discrimination, even love. Knowing when and where to eat it, how, with whom, and in what quantity are matters of gravity, worth a lifetime of effort. Any business lunch in France, serious discussion doesn't take place until the end of the meal between the pear and the cheese. Shrewd observers can tell a lot about a person from the way he handles cheese. Deals have failed because someone ate the épois before the brie or gobbled all the blue part of the roquefort while leaving the less tasty white. It's just another damning piece of evidence against what the French call la perfide Albion, perfidious England, that the British, confronted with a wheel of Stilton, their equivalent of roquefort, slice off the top rind and spoon out the blue heart, leaving latecomers to struggle along with what remains. Worse, they sometimes pour a glass of port into the hollow, rendering it a soggy mush. Quelle cochonnerie. Nor does it surprise them that James Joyce, however long he lived in France, should always have scorned its most nationalist of foods. A corpse is meat gone bad, he sneered. Well, and what's cheese? Corpse of milk. They forgive him a lot on account of his genius, but not that.
Corpse of milk and scorning perfidious England there in Immovable Feast, A Paris Christmas by John Baxter. Let's get one more call. Phyllis in Weston, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Phyllis.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to mention the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society.
Oh, you've got to be kidding.
No.
That's a funny title.
Well, that was the cover title.
Yes.
To keep the Germans at bay during the Second World War. The Isle of Guernsey in the Channel Islands was the only area that was occupied by the Germans during the war.
Yes.
And this is the story of a young English writer in 1946 who becomes enamored with the very quirky and enchanting, delightful people on the island. And the whole book is written in letters, and how she becomes a great fan of the way of life and how they lived when they had this presence among them.
It's totally delightful.
You
take us right to the end of our clock, Phyllis, but we've got it, the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society, and I see this by Marianne Schaefer and Annie Barrows, and we thank you for that recommendation as well. Liesl, so many others on your list we haven't got to. I mean, you've got some fun stuff on The Grift by Deborah Ginsberg, not literature, you say, but a psychic thriller set in San Diego, and a thumbs up from you and a whole bunch more. A good year in the end? A good vintage, Liesl?
Well, I've read so many books, both fiction and nonfiction, this year that I thought were really strong, and I just think next year, without an election to distract us, hopefully we'll all be a bit more focused on just how good what we're reading is.
We'll lift a glass to that, and thanks to each of you, Liesl Schillinger, Chris Kleindienst with Left Bank Books, and Mark Sarvis with The Elegant Variation. Thanks to all of you. Really wonderful to gather around the table and hear your recommendations. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Happy reading.